From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Here's one of the big questions at the heart of Laurel Thatcher Ulrich's latest book. Why were early Mormon women so willing to defend polygamy, a system most everyone at the time found perverse and degrading? Well, no surprise, it's complicated. One obvious reason is they defended it because their community was being threatened and their families. But Ulrich says that's only part of it. Another reason is these women were fierce about women's rights. They were aware and inspired by the radical energy of the time. Today in the program, Ulrich is joining us to talk about her 8-year exploration of this story. And she did it by looking at these women's diaries and their meetings and the Relief Society, which was a kind of incubator for their spiritual identity and their political activism. Join us after the news.
Purchase the books that you hear featured on Radio West by clicking the IndieBound, Amazon, or Audible links included with each show at RadioWest.org. A portion of proceeds from these affiliate partners supports Radio West. While you're there, you can check out all the show archives. Thanks for listening.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In the 19th century, when observers noticed Mormon women were among those speaking out for suffrage, they assumed one of the things women would do with a vote is get rid of polygamy. But that's not really how it worked. The women in the Utah Territory of the time who attended meetings and spoke out about women's rights were just as fierce in their defense of plural marriage. And in her new book, the historian Laurel Thatcher Ulrich is trying to figure out why. Why women could, on one hand, support a campaign for their political rights and then, on the other hand, support a system that seemed so patriarchal. One of the reasons, she says, is that these women had already shown a willingness to push against the grain. She describes them in the book as religious seekers. Before they were Latter-day Saints, they were Quakers and Methodists and Campbellites. And when they chose Mormonism, they showed they were willing to risk everything. Some abandoned comfortable homes and families. Some abandoned legal husbands to follow Joseph Smith or Brigham Young. So why wouldn't they have a mind of their own when it came to plural marriage? Laurel Thatcher Ulrich is joining us in the studio today. Her new book is called A House Full of Females, and she's in Utah to talk about it. And joining us here, as I said, she's an historian, a professor at Harvard University. You may know she won the 1991 Pulitzer Prize for her book, A Midwife's Tale. She's also a former MacArthur Foundation Fellow, and she's going to be doing readings this week. We'll give you the particulars about that a little bit later. But Laurel Thatcher Ulrich, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Delighted to be here.
I guess I wanted to begin with your personal connection to this story, the fact that you grew up in the Intermountain West. You grew up in, what was it, Sugar City, Idaho?
Sugar City.
What a great name.
Yeah.
And you had certainly plural marriage in the family. I
mean, sure.
Your family came west, yes?
My family came west.
Yes.
On all four sides, my great-grandparents, couple of sets of great-great-grandparents were part of that great migration. Not all were polygamous, yeah. But some were. Some happily, some not so happily.
Right. And you've said that you've explored your family's stories about all of this in personal essays before, but this is the first time you've written about early Mormonism as a work of scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that? That seems odd. Why wait until now?
Because I was trained to work in colonial and revolutionary America.
You got distracted.
Absolutely. I did graduate school late as a faculty wife in a small state university in New England, and wouldn't have been practical to work on Mormon history from Durham, New Hampshire. So I took up the field where nobody was really working at the time on issues of women and gender and loved it.
In colonial America.
Colonial, northern New England, the first book, and then A Midwife's Tale, which was this wonderful diary from Maine in the years just after the American Revolution. So I fell in love with New England. And also, I like the distance, the scholarly distance. I mean, it's one thing to write personal essays, but I think as historians, we like to think that we can look through a scholarly lens. Not that we don't care about our topics. I care deeply about women's history. But it's nice not to feel personally implicated by the stories.
So why did you figure you would reach into this subject where you did have a personal connection, where you weren't so distant?
Oh, it's time.
Yeah.
I'm past 70. Is this the time to do something risky?
Yeah. Do you think of it as risky?
Oh, I'm joking.
Yeah.
I mean, the situation of people who write about Mormon history is the first thing they want to know is, are you a Mormon?
Yeah.
And then you become the topic rather than your work. And that, I don't particularly welcome that, but then I've never made a secret about my religious affiliation, and those questions are fair.
Yeah. How do you describe, not your relationship with Mormonism, but this is a very fraught subject these days.
Oh, yes.
So how are you, now you don't navigate your personal opinions in the book.
No.
So we don't need to spend a lot of time with it. But I am interested in sort of the way you're perceiving women's rights within Mormonism today, because it does apply.
Oh, of course. And I'm very interested in that. I mean, my personal self, my exponent to personal self, because I have been very much engaged in Mormon feminism, and there is, of course, such a thing, comes in many guises. One of the things that I can say about the contemporary situation in Mormon feminism is this sudden resurgence after a period of kind of quiet.
Yeah.
So the new book that came out, that Joanna Books had edited on essential feminism or essential Mormon feminism, is full of material from the 70s and 80s and then this great gap.
Yeah.
And so younger women, I hear this constantly, they can't believe that this earlier incarnation of thought on women was there. They grew up not knowing about it, very much the way I grew up never having heard of 19th century Mormon feminism.
It's interesting. It seems like there's maybe a theme in there, or maybe a cycle, because you write about the fact that there was the organization of the Relief Society.
Yes.
Brigham Young did away with it. We can get back to that here in a moment.
Yeah.
But then it was reorganized. There was a resurgence of sort of, I guess, feminism, if you could put it that way, for the time. So there was a gap there, too.
Oh, absolutely. And this is not about Mormonism. This is about gender.
Yeah.
And women.
They had stuff to do.
And they had stuff to do, but it's also very much about male-female relationships and relationships of authority. Mm. So one of the great surprises, I don't know why this was a surprise, but one of the fascinations of my research for the book was to see how much, I don't want to exaggerate the term, but I would say how much gender tension or gender conflict there was in early Mormonism. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we tend to think of the rock solid pioneers all together or the dangerous dissenters.
Yeah.
But what was fascinating to me was to see the interplay of relations of power among women and among women and men from the beginning.
Yeah.
From the beginning. And why should I be surprised? I'm a historian of women. It's in every society. It's part of who we are as human beings.
But that was, I guess, one of the big takeaways for me is that these women came to Mormonism, in many cases, already engaged political, spiritual beings. They were already informed by the society of the time, the politics of the time. They already had their ideas, so why wouldn't they offer their own opinions about gender in mainstream Mormonism?
Right. Well, To make that a bit more nuanced, there really is no visible women's rights movement. There's certainly not an organized political women's suffrage movement in the 1830s and 40s.
Right.
What there are communitarian societies, utopian societies, people interested in dress reform, health reform, alcohol reform, I mean, the early temperance movement, and Latter-day Saints. I mean, if you know the Mormon history, you know that those themes touch everything in Mormonism. But above
those were
all,
what you called the radical energies of the 30s and 40s.
Radical energies. Yeah. Let's remake the world. But fundamentally, these religious movements, nearly every one of those reform movements has not the same stance, sure, but a stance on religious questions. And Mormonism as a religious movement was indeed radical.
Yeah.
There is revelation ongoing, but especially we need to gather and create this new Jerusalem, this new society. I mean, conservatives are not going to do that.
Yeah, yeah. I want to get back to this gathering because it's an important theme, I think, for these women. But you say these women, as sort of I mentioned in the introduction, they had always been willing to sort of go against the grain. So a lot of them, as you've said, they left legal husbands. They left very comfortable family situations to follow Mormonism. So mm-hmm. this was, as you say, this was a pretty radical mm-hmm. thing to follow Mormonism at the time.
Right, right. You know, I'll give you a couple of examples, both New England women. And one is a major figure in the book because I use her husband's diary so extensively. The diary of Wilford Woodruff yeah. is a basic source. But Phoebe Carter, what fascinated me as I learned about her was she was 30 years old. She leaves Scarborough, Maine, where her family have been for generations and are fairly prominent, although, you know, New England's having troubles. You know, one brother's at sea, another's gone to New York to learn to be a merchant. She leaves her family and goes to Kirtland, Ohio to join the Latter-day Saints because she's listened to missionaries who are coming through Maine. And in the first chapter of the book, I talk about an amazing letter that survived that she wrote to her parents. It was really painful. She is so close to her family and to her sisters, and yet God wants me to do this. I mean, think of the distance. Today, we may not think of Maine and Ohio as far apart, but that's a long journey. And there she is, as she describes herself, a lone maid. Well, she's an old maid, too,
yeah,
by
at 30
New
in those
England
times.
Terms. She's
sure.
30.
Yeah.
So there are lots of women like that. And the most flamboyant is Augusta Cobb, who about the same time joins the church. But she's married and has a family and a husband who's relatively prosperous up and down in the economy. She's running a boarding house for a time in Boston, lots of kids. He does not like Mormonism.
Right.
She insists on staying with the church. And at some point, when some of the 12 apostles come through, she joins them
yeah.
and goes back to, by then, the church is in Nauvoo, and she becomes a plural wife of Brigham Young. Tate has to leave her children. She's able to take one child with her eventually. Yeah. There's a divorce. There's a scandal. But she's not going to budge.
That's indicative of these women.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting. I want to ask you about your approach to this book, which is like your approach for the other books as well. This is something, a midwife's tale, as I mentioned. You received the Pulitzer Prize for it. And you wrote, you said this, you said your training in social history and then your own experience as a mother and as a neighbor and the kinds of things that, as you said, we do when raising a family made me want to say, what about these invisible people we know so little about?
Mm-hmm.
So that's really where your idea comes from, to focus on one woman, this 18th century diary in a midwife's
uh-huh.
tale. And it's the same impulse for a house full of females, it seems. More than one woman, obviously, here.
Yeah.
But still, you extract from the day-to-day existence of their lives
right.
their bigger story, I guess.
Right, right. So there are two themes there, I think, that resonate with me. One is the interest in the everyday, which really does go back to my very earliest work. Even as a graduate student, I was trained as a social historian. So social historians like to think we work history from the bottom up rather than top down. It's not great man history. And so much history still is great man history.
Right.
So that it's that impulse. And of course, I came up through the 1960s. So, you know, my own political orientation reinforces that. But the other part of it is how we know what we know about the past. And at this political moment in the United States, we're all concerned about how we know what we know. Government issues of a report, we don't see the documents. Well, one of the things that historians do, scholarly historians, academic historians, you know, we bore people to death, some people think, no, we let you know how we know. And you can look up our sources and you can disagree with me if you want to. But for me, focusing on first person day-by-day accounts was a driving force in this book. And it was a bit radical because virtually no one writes Mormon history that way. I'll probably get in trouble for making a slam dunk statement here. But most work on Mormon history relies heavily on memoirs and retrospective accounts written later. Yeah. And those are fabulous, but they're shaped by the period in which they're written.
Yeah.
So I wanted to go back. What were they saying at the time when
they didn't know the outcome?
They didn't know the outcome.
Yeah.
They had no idea. They're confused. They're puzzled. Will that come through in what they say and in what they do? Hmm. And yes, indeed, it did come through.
I want to ask you just briefly about Wilfred Woodruff's diary, because there's a section early on where you talk about the importance of diaries and how interesting they were. And Woodruff was a great diary writer.
Great diary.
5,000 pages typewritten, if you were to add it all up. That's pretty amazing. Talk a little bit about what were they like, his diaries? He said that he was interested in not just the mundane, but it seems like he wrote a lot about the mundane as well.
Oh, he did. Yes. He thinks he's creating scripture.
Right.
Absolutely. He labels his diary the first book of Wilfred.
Wow.
You know, it's like, you know, he's been reading the Book of Mormon and he knows. And also one of Joseph Smith's revelations says to these young men who go out as missionaries, these first Mormon preachers, you know, what you say when moved upon by the Holy Ghost is scripture.
Yeah.
So it's a very powerful thing for him. So at one point he says to, as he's an older man trying to convince other people to keep diaries, just stick with the, you know, you're moved upon by the Holy Ghost. You don't need to write down what you ate unless, you know, an angel fed you like Elijah, and then you can write that down.
Right.
Well, he's very funny sometimes. You know, he has his tongue-in-cheek humor. But, you know, he writes down a lot of things, including one day in 1857, as he begins his daily diary entry, he uses this phrase, found the house full of females.
Yeah.
And when I came to that passage, I just loved it. And I knew I had a title for my book.
Explain what was going on, because this was a meeting of the Relief Society. His wife, Phoebe, you mentioned, was president. And there were 50 women there, and they were making a quilt.
And they made a quilt to raise money, you know, classic 19th century activity for a benevolent society. But as that quilt got bigger and bigger and bigger, and eventually there were 70 squares in this quilt, each of them signed by the woman who made it, things get really hot and terrible in Utah, and we discover that the president is sending Johnson's army, what will become eventually known as the Utah War. Right. And so embedded in what looks like, in fact, is so much like other 19th century autograph quilts that you would never know anything was going on. They're using the similar patterns, similar embroidery techniques. It's this dramatic story about the place of women in supporting their faith during a time of great crisis. So when a woman signs, Great Salt Lake and the date, I mean, or In God We Trust, these little mottos, or an American eagle, a symbol of the American eagle, what could be more bland? Well, the poetry at the time, the American eagle has died in the East and it's moved to Utah where we uphold true liberty. And so it becomes a kind of defiant statement of support in a classic feminine vehicle of this gorgeous needlework.
It's a beautiful quilt, and I'm so glad it still exists. Somebody down the line cut it in half.
Yes.
And then it was separated for a while, but it's happily been brought back together.
And thanks to Carolyn Nielsen and her wonderful work and her University of Utah book.
Yeah.
She wrote a book about it and has kindly helped me as I've elaborated on her work and brought it into this larger narrative about women in early Utah.
You say that in some ways your book is like that quilt.
It is. It's very much like a quilt in that it's made of pieces.
Yeah.
So I had Wilford Woodruff more than 60 years every day, if you can imagine.
Every day he wrote?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? He recorded something for every day.
Yeah.
Sometimes he would go back and fill in. But it's pretty continuous. And I'm not going to write a book about Wilford Woodruff. I'm
exactly.
a historian of women.
Exactly.
I mean, I love the diary. And I feel, I love the voice and the calligraphy and all of the wonderful things in that diary. But I thought, as I was imagining this book, I'll do a kind of parallel. So I'll find a woman's diary that goes for 60 years. Oh, yeah.
Harder to find.
Good luck.
This was interesting. You said that there are a lot more men's diaries from the time. 10 to 1 in some
10 to 1.
Yeah.
And
wow.
The women's diaries tend to be fragmented.
Right.
Part because our lives are fragmented.
Yeah, they're busy.
And also because they don't get saved necessarily in the same way because they're not in positions of authority. It makes a huge difference.
Can we say, just while you're on that point, because this sounds crazy, Eliza Snow's diary was almost burned. Came this close to being burned.
Oh, yes. And even more amazing, the minutes that she kept of the Nauvoo Relief Society. Could there be any document of more value to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints than those minutes? They survived because she took care of them and because she passed them down to her successors in the Relief Society. But until last year, they had never been available to the full membership. Small quotations had.
Yeah.
So
I want to ask you about that just before we move on, because you say some of the passages in this ledger, in this diary that she kept about the minutes of the Relief Society appeared to contradict ideas about how women had access to priesthood, whether they had access to priesthood, whether they were able to do blessings and, things that, because that's a contentious issue today among some women. The church controlled the access. As you say, it wasn't until last year that people were able to actually get access to all of this. What does it reveal about female access to priesthood now? Can you say?
Well, I can't really comment in full detail on the question of the theology of female priesthood. What I can say definitively as a historian is that it was contradictory from the beginning. And that it had multiple interpretations over time. And it appeared that in the early Nauvoo period, Joseph Smith says, "I will make of this society a kingdom of priests, as in Enoch's day, as in," and so on, and used continuous allusions to male priesthood in writing about female priesthood. I mean, there's a kind of parallelism in the way these minutes of the Relief Society describe it. And there certainly was confusion because Emma Smith, who was president of the Nauvoo Female Relief Society.
And just for those uninitiated,
legal wife of Joseph Smith. And in the Nauvoo period, as the secret practice of plural marriage became known to, not to everybody, it certainly wasn't publicly announced, but became controversial within the church, Brigham Young concluded that Emma had been trying to undermine plural marriage and use her authority, which she forthrightly claimed she had. "If anyone has authority, I do, as the president of the Relief Society." So, gone, the Relief Society.
Yeah, he ditched it.
After Joseph Smith's death, the Relief Society is gone. And he said to them in one meeting of men, "If you see women huddling together, you stop it, because it can only lead to trouble." So, you know, I didn't know that as I was growing up. And I doubt if very many other members of the Relief Society knew that as well. So it disappeared. But the essence of it did not disappear.
This sense of gathering, this sense of communicating, engaging with the issues of the day.
The sense of blessing, healing,
even that.
Exercising spiritual gifts continued. And with the support of men, but the danger is collective, organized activity, and so it's this fascinating dance through the early Utah period about what women can or cannot do. That is, can you gather your sisters together? It sounds like 17th century Boston and Anne Hutchinson, you know? It was wonderful that women get together and study the scriptures. Well, if they start questioning the minister, they're in trouble. And so I think Brigham and other leaders were worried about that, and other leaders were not. I mean, there were men who said, you know, "I got more spirituality in this meeting led by, you know, one of the sisters than anywhere I've been." So to go back to what I said earlier, this tension over male and female roles is endemic in humans, and it was very much present in early Mormonism. What is interesting, in a period where nothing was more disreputable than a Mormon, than a woman's rights activist, that is, it was a very patriarchal society in general, that within this community there was a spiritual opening through the Relief Society minutes and through spiritual practices for a sense of empowerment by women.
I want to get back to that when we come back from a break. Laurel Thatcher Ulrich is with us. Her new book is A House Full of Females. Tomorrow night at 6 o'clock, she's going to be speaking at Benchmark Books in Salt Lake City. Wednesday night, she's going to be at the Salt Lake City Public Library. We have links to all of that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a quick break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Laurel Thatcher Ulrich. She's the one, by the way, who wrote the saying that you may have seen on a T-shirt or a mug, "Well-behaved women seldom make history." Ulrich grew up in the Intermountain West. Her family was part of the early Mormon migration to the Salt Lake Valley. She has family members who practiced polygamy, as she said, but her new book is her first attempt to write about Mormonism and plural marriage as a scholar. Her book is called A House Full of Females, Plural Marriage and Women's Rights in Early Mormonism from 1835 to 1870. There are a number of places she's going to be speaking this week. We'll give you details about that a little bit later on the program. I want to get back to this. We were talking about this concept of gathering, how
yes.
it was so important to them. And you say plural wives stood up for their church, stood up for even the practice of plural marriage, not because they were good, strong pioneer stock, but because, you say, the concept of gathering was at the heart of Mormon theology. What do you mean by that? Explain that.
Well, it's complicated, but it's geographic and it's also spiritual. So the geographic part is once you're a Mormon, you're kind of in trouble because if you really embrace the faith, you need to be with other Mormons.
Right.
You don't just find a congregation in your hometown. So there's this constant migration and this constant outreach of missionary work, bringing people together into one place who have a common destiny, they believe, to prepare a place where Jesus can come again.
Yeah.
We're going to create this new Jerusalem, this holy city, and we'll be there in the millennium. The spiritual gathering is also complex. I think we don't realize how disruptive the 19th century was of family life in general,
right.
Because everybody's migrating from farm to city
yep.
or from east to west. But Mormons really take that to a new level, and they make it a spiritual gathering. You're not going to the gold fields. You're not just going to find a better farm.
Right.
You're going to create a better world.
Yeah.
With other like-minded people. And so in a wonderful little poem that Eliza Snow wrote at one point in Utah, she says, you know, I can't remember the exact quote. I'm either English or German or Dane or Italian. I'm a Latter-day Saint. So it becomes a kind of ethnicity. Mormonism, I think, really is, particularly for people who sort of grew up in the church, as I did, it's an ethnicity.
Yeah. It's interesting. You also say gathering taught these women that retreating into a private haven was neither possible nor righteous. Do you mean that this idea of gathering informed their activism in that let's get together and talk about the things that matter to us, women's rights, suffrage, those things included?
I think that's very much true. These are readers of newspapers.
Yeah.
Even if it takes 3 months to get them to Utah,
yeah.
they read them. They respond to them. But what I really, part of the implication of that statement is gathering created conflict. And we see this today, I mean, we look at a world of religious and ethnic conflict. So Mormons wouldn't have been very threatening if they had been sprinkled around
right.
the United States. They also probably wouldn't have been Mormons because, it was the cohesiveness
yeah.
and the bringing together that created the culture. But that was what threatened their neighbors because they were different.
Yeah.
And so there's constant persecution. This is not a nation that thinks of religious liberty the way we do today at all. It's a very local authority structure, and it's a place where people take up guns. They burn barns if they don't like each other.
Right, right. It's interesting you mentioned that nothing outraged Mormon women of the time more than the idea that they were just pawns
oh,
to
yeah.
a patriarchy.
Yes.
I hated the idea of that.
Yes. This really is significant because there are two ways to approach Mormonism and particularly the conflict over plural marriage. One is, to attack Brigham Young or Joseph Smith or whatever. The other is to pity the women, to consider them poor victims, either dupes or they've been tricked. I mean, the anti-Mormon literature used the language of captivity.
Yeah, they're enslaved.
They're enslaved. We can pity them. And, you know, these women, they were in a tough spot. But in almost all cases, they chose to be there. And that outraged them. And I think many of them didn't particularly like polygamy. But they're not going to let outsiders use that aspect of their faith to diminish them as human beings and to destroy their community that they had built.
You say in the book that there is some evidence to support this assumption that Joseph Smith used plural marriage to justify illicit relations with vulnerable young women. Uh-huh. So you don't stay away from that question. And so what is revealed in the diaries of women and their everyday about what they think about the fact that there is now plural marriage and where this came from and whose idea this was and whether Joseph Smith was just doing it to, you know, exercise his sort of sexual power.
Oh, my goodness. What a question. when I originally started this book, I was really interested in the long game. I thought I was going to go from 1835 to 1896.
Statehood.
And I was thinking, yeah, one chapter for Nauvoo, you know, ended up with three chapters for Nauvoo. And that is very peculiar because there are virtually no day-by-day diaries for Nauvoo. And the ones that exist, and they're extremely important, are a diary by William Clayton, one by Eliza Snow, and one by Zinah Huntington, Zinah D.H. Young.
Yeah.
And these are, and then the Nauvoo release Saudi minutes. Only one is explicit about polygamy, and that's William Clayton. William Clayton is very explicit. He's thrilled when he has the opportunity to take another wife. And he happens to be a clerk of Joseph Smith. So we get closer to plural marriage in Nauvoo through the diary of William Clayton than we can possibly do through these other diaries if what we want to understand is how a man saw it, how one man saw it. Now, there are fragmentary responses in the writings of Heber Kimball and even cryptic ones in Wilford Woodruff. I think Clayton is a very special case in that he's very young, he's very open. Yeah. He would like to marry everybody in sight, I think. I mean, it's just incredible. But also Clayton reveals his understanding of Joseph Smith's relationship with Emma. I don't want to say he reveals Joseph's relationship with Emma because this is through Clayton's eyes.
Exactly.
But there's no question but what there's trouble in the mansion house. And Emma is deeply troubled over polygamy. And Joseph is deeply troubled over Emma's reaction. He weeps. He'll promise her whatever he can give her to keep her from suing for divorce. I mean, it's a pretty sad place.
Yeah, but then on the other hand, he receives revelation from God saying,
"Yes, and that
you'll
is
be
the,
condemned."
That
or
is the setting of the 132nd section of the Doctrine and Covenants. For those who know that work of Scripture, it was not public. Joseph Smith was adamant about record keeping. He was adamant about promulgating his revelations, not this one. Yeah. And surely that's about Emma.
Yeah. God says, get in line, Emma. Basically.
Right. And if he's going to keep Emma, yeah, I think there's probably pretty good evidence he did back away. And then he's killed.
So you don't know where that practice may have been headed if Joseph Smith had stayed alive?
No, we don't know. And we don't know whether it would have been resolved. I think as Latter-day Saints, we really have to be honest and look at multiple possibilities for what really was going on in Nauvoo. Now, having said that, I want to come back to the diarists who don't mention polygamy, but you know darn well they know about it.
Sure.
So you want to see what they're thinking and what they're saying. And what amazes me as I read them is I'm thinking of Heber Kimball. I mean, talk about weeping. You know, I would cry like a baby if I would do anything to hurt you, dear Valette, he's writing to his first wife. And there's this struggle between a feeling of respect for Joseph Smith's revelations and then their own efforts to get some kind of confirmation that, and a sense that they're doing something that's really going to be a problem.
Yeah.
And it is going to be a problem. So what intrigues me is not Emma's opposition, my goodness. It's a very, very sad moment in Mormon history because Joseph Smith's death not only brings a rift in the church, which is well documented, but something else that I don't think we've talked enough about, a rift in the community of women.
Right.
About a third of the members of the Female Relief Society stay behind when the saints go west. Two-thirds go, though. We don't know how many of them are conscious of plural marriage.
Right, because it wasn't public, I guess.
It wasn't public, although it becomes pretty much an inside secret because of the temple, and there's a great expansion in plural marriages after Joseph Smith's death. Mm-hmm. But what intrigues me is how these plural wives are the ones who come west and create the Female Relief Society again and are the ones who then become the visible public advocates for women's rights. It really is paradoxical. I mean, it's not, I mean, you can imagine what had happened if two-thirds had gone with Emma.
Yeah.
So
wait, are you saying that the most kind of, the fiercest, the most engaged were among those two-thirds who came west?
Of plural marriage.
Of plural marriage.
Absolutely.
Wow.
Absolutely. And this is true later, although I'm getting on thin ice here because some of my colleagues can do a better job of this later period after the women's suffrage movement, because there are women who leave, like Fanny Stenhouse, who had been a Mormon convert. But they don't go to the women's suffrage movement.
Yeah.
It's the polygamists and the Orthodox Mormons who go to the women's suffrage movement. So there's something about that I haven't fully explained, but it's an ability, I think, to push back in different ways. Hmm. The Eastern suffragists did not like polygamy.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask
you
about. So when Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton come to Salt Lake City to speak to this group of women about the importance of universal suffrage and women getting the vote, they knew the women in this audience were many of them.
Plural
wives.
And they thought they would liberate them, you
right.
know, like everybody else. We're going to give you the real truth, and then we'll be through. But Stanton was really savvy. And her comment, published in their own newspaper, The Revolution, and comment to the press, I think is just crucial to understanding how you could have this weird alliance between plural wives and women's suffragists. And she said, the problem is not polygamy. Polygamy and monogamy are both bad.
Right.
Because it's
about, they subjugate women.
It's subjugate women.
Yeah.
It's about male dominance.
Right.
And as long as women are dependent on men for bread, you're never going to solve this problem.
Seems like a pretty diplomatic response on her part.
I think it was diplomatic, but it was also true.
Yeah.
I mean, she went after the Bible. She went after lots of things. And so what intrigues me is how many Mormon women knew about the first national women's suffrage convention was in 1850 in Worcester, Massachusetts. They knew about that, and they knew about other women's suffrage conventions. They're reading the newspaper, and, you know, Eliza Snow said, oh, we don't need that, you know. These conventionists should come west and meet our fabulous men, and they would no longer need this movement. I mean, it's really quite crazy. But anyway, you know, at a time when these perfect men are not letting them reorganize the Relief Society, I mean, it's just a very complex phenomenon. But it tells me Eliza Snow sure cared about women's rights. It's a theme. It's a motif through her poetry. She doesn't understand it in the same way or frame it in the same way. It's a spiritual integrity, an ability to be an independent communion with God and to stand up for things that you believe.
When we come back from a quick break, I want to talk about this amazing painting that's on the cover of your book.
Good.
Laurel Thatcher Ulrich is with us. Her new book is called A House Full of Females. Tomorrow night, she's going to be speaking at Benchmark Books. Wednesday night, she's speaking at the Salt Lake City Public Library. We have links to all of that on our website, radiowest.org. A quick break, and back for some final thoughts. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back with Laurel Thatcher Ulrich. We're talking about her new book, A House Full of Females. She's in Utah, not here all the time. She teaches at Harvard, but she's in Utah talking about the book, and we have details about that on our website. She's joining us here in the studio. These households you describe in Mormonism, these households of plural marriage, you describe them as incubators of female activism, like in the Lion House in downtown Salt Lake City, which most people know as Brigham Young's house, where Eliza Snow's just a few doors down from Harriet Cook, and Xenia Young is just down the hallway too. This architectural structure, the Lion House, it was pretty unique. Talk a little bit about that, if you would, the sort of the structure of all of this, because I think that'll get us to the painting.
Okay, great. Actually, I just gave a paper at a historical meeting in Denver about the Lion House and the Beehive House, and I talked about them as boarding houses. Huh. And in the 19th century, as one scholar has said, it was the age of the private house, the haven in the heartless world, you know, of a kind of sequestered domesticity.
Yeah.
Boarding houses were dangerous places. They were flourishing everywhere because there were people who couldn't afford a house. There were workers. There were utopians. There were all these people. So the Lion House had this kind of aura of kind of scary place, and they called it a harem.
Right.
Because there were maybe at some point as many as 15 wives of Brigham Young inhabited there. It had 10 gables on each side. People who live in Utah have seen this.
Yep.
And it was a kind of boarding house with a bell to come down for dinner and prayers. But it was also a cooperative workspace. It was a school. These were educated women. It was a place where women didn't have to cook dinner. A common utopian reform of the era.
Right.
And so it was a place where people could gather. I would not want to overstate plural marriage as the only way in which women associated in this period, because Eliza Snow and Harriet Cook and others who were leaders were constantly visiting and moving back and forth in various ways with women in other households. So there's all this cross-cutting interaction among women. But the Lion House is virtually unique.
Yeah.
Brigham Young was really out there when he built this, but that's not the way most Latter-day Saints lived.
I've got about 2 minutes left. So talk about this painting and what it seems to convey about the relationships with women, because it's you were obviously sort of moved by it.
I was very much. I discovered it late, hard to find people illustrations. I could find lots of needlework from early Mormon women, but this is a genre painting. Found at the last minute, the Springville Art Museum, just a gorgeous little painting done by C.C.A. Christensen, the famous muralist and painter of pioneering. And he created this for his good friend, Frederick Ferdinand Dorius, who had been a missionary companion in Denmark, on celebrating the birth of a baby. And it's called Weighing the Baby. So what you see is you see a bearded guy opening the door to the outside, like, oh, I made it, the baby has been born. But inside is this house full of females.
Yeah.
And they include, I don't have documented identities for everyone, but Dorius had two wives at this point. I'm thinking the woman in the golden dress weighing the baby is the first wife.
Right.
And then the mother is in bed. She was just, the birth has just been completed. The little baby in a sling being weighed with the stillards as you'd weigh the meat or whatever on the farm. Little kids running around, other women, an older woman who has a pipe in her mouth, which I just loved because there's a legend about my great-great-grandmother who was from Virginia who smoked. But to me, that community around the birth, around childcare, and nursing and healing and women's work is the core of everything, not just in Mormonism. This painting, if these were friends and neighbors and sisters, they don't have to be plural wives. They happen to be plural wives. Plural marriage was built upon that kind of female community, informal union among women. And then it went someplace else.
Laurel Thatcher Ulrich. Her new book is called A House Full of Females. Tomorrow night, she's speaking at Benchmark Books. She's going to be speaking at the Salt Lake City Public Library on Wednesday night. You can get links to all of that on our website, radiowest.org. Thank you very much for the time.
Thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Tim Slover. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.